Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Barring some last-minute collapse, the stimulus bill is pretty much all wrapped up, $789 billion in direct spending and tax cuts, which means the really tricky part has started, trying to figure out if that thing's working. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Today is Thursday, the 12th of February. Great to have you here. Officially, it's still under negotiation in a House Senate conference committee, but it is fair to say the stimulus package the president's going to sign sometime soon is going to look a lot like the agreement announced yesterday, a $789 billion bag of mixed economic policies. The president had nice things to say about the congressional version of the plan, that it's still going to create or save 3.5 million jobs. Even if it does, though, is that going to be enough to drive up consumption and so do what it's supposed to do, stimulate the economy? And if it does, how would you measure that anyway? From Washington, Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer has more.
Everybody gave up something in the congressional negotiations over the stimulus bill. There'll be less money for school construction and tax cuts. Workers will now only see about 13 extra bucks a week from the payroll tax cut. That may only increase consumption at the dollar store.
I would like it to have been bigger.
Alan Blinder teaches economics at Princeton.
Unfortunately, a lot of what happened in the compromising and scaling back of the program took some of the stimulative bite out of it.
Still, Blinder says it's better than nothing. Low-income consumers tend to spend every extra dollar they get, so they could help stimulate the economy. Tax cuts for businesses are designed to get them to boost production, but companies will only hire and buy new equipment if they think the economy is improving. Tyler Cowan teaches economics at George Mason University. He says stimulus money for local governments will at least stabilize consumption.
Because they will otherwise be cutting their spending now, and that can, to some extent, be prevented. More of the bill should do that.
As it is, Cowan thinks it'll take a year for the stimulus spending to have any effect on consumption. Nigel Gault says we could see some small growth at the end of this year. Gault is chief U.S. economist at IHS Global Insight. He's tried to measure the impact of the stimulus.
You know, it may reduce the peak unemployment rate perhaps by about a percentage point.
But Gault says there's a wide margin for error. The White House uses complex formulas to figure out the impact of each stimulus dollar. But Gault says models don't always work. They assume people and businesses will act in a certain way. But that's not always the case, especially during a recession, when caution is the rule. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
The real estate analysis firm RealtyTrack dispensed its monthly dose of bad news today. Foreclosure filings are still going up. 274,000 homes went into default or were seized by the bank in January. That is the 10th month in a row that foreclosure filings have been above 250,000. Meanwhile, the National Association of Realtors says median home prices dropped again, off more than 12% in the fourth quarter from a year earlier. We asked Ashley Milne-Tite just how much all those foreclosures are affecting those prices.
With its unmowed lawn and peeling paint, a foreclosed home doesn't just blight the neighborhood. It drags down the prices of homes all around it. Mike Larson of Weiss Research says buyers won't offer top dollar on a house in a street splotched with foreclosures. And he says if you want to sell your home for $200,000, but a bank wants to offload the foreclosed home down the block for $150,000...
You're competing against a much lower price point. And if that house sells, not only does that go into the models that determine home values, it also forces you to price your home for less because you're competing against an aggressive seller.
And so the spiral of low prices continues. Greg McBride of Bankrate.com says as for that 12% drop in the median price of a home, well, there were fewer homes for sale last quarter than the year before, and the people selling are mainly those who really need to.
People that don't have to sell their houses are in many cases choosing not to, instead opting to stay in the home a while longer, wait for home values to stabilize, and if they decide to move on at that point, they feel they might get a fairer price at some point down the road.
In the meantime, though, with so many foreclosures on the market, waiting it out requires some fortitude. But Weiss Research's Mike Larson says ultimately those foreclosed properties will sell quickly and clear surplus inventory off the market.
In markets where foreclosures are very high and prices have fallen a lot, you're actually seeing sales volume pick up. So lower home prices aren't part of the problem, they're part of the solution.
He says that clear out will soak up the excess supply and prices will start rising again. In New York, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Art hasn't exactly been imitating life when it comes to the economy lately, and that is probably a good thing. But a couple of movies that are opening this weekend might reverse that trend. For those with financial revenge fantasies, there is The International, the story of a truly bad bank that's brought down by a dashing Interpol agent. And for the conspicuous consumer in withdrawal out there, there's Confessions of a Shopaholic, about a woman who goes crazy with her credit cards. It is the world we live in, but is it entertainment? Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith checked it out.
American buying power is behind 20% of the world economy. We're a nation of shopaholics.
Dress, Zac Posen. Belt, Todd Oldham Vintage. Bag, Gucci.
At least we were. Then came the credit crunch.
Declined.
Can you try again?
Really declined.
That's Rebecca Bloomwood, star of Confessions of a Shopaholic. It's a movie, but it comes uncomfortably close to real life. So will women want to head to a theater to relive the glory days of careless credit card spending? Marketing expert Mary Lou Quinlan doesn't think so.
I just wonder if women will feel like you're rubbing their nose in what they can't have anymore. It's like window shopping with no money in your pocket.
Then there's The International, where a couple of rogue do-gooders take down a corrupt and murderous bank. Brad Adgate with Horizon Media predicts that timely revenge fantasy could be a draw.
Sure, I think that you might see a loud cheer in the theater when something bad happens to the bank. It's kind of like in the zeitgeist of today.
Still, Daily Variety's Stuart Levine says traditionally people aren't too keen on movies dealing with current problems.
I just don't think people want to pay $10 to see the bad stuff they could read for free on the internet at home and watch on TV at home.
But don't write the obit for conspicuous consumption or financial idolatry just yet. Marketing expert Mary Lou Quinlan predicts as soon as the economy turns around, we'll fall back in love with our old ways.
That's what America does. America buys and builds and makes and wants, and it's really hard to imagine that those lessons will stick if things get flush again.
In other words, Confessions of a Shopaholic and The International could have a long life on DVD. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
President Obama can hang that help wanted sign right back up in the cabinet room. The Commerce Secretary job is proving really hard to fill. New Hampshire Senator Judd Gregg announced today he is withdrawing his name from consideration. No tax problems this time, though. Gregg, who is a Republican, says he and the president have critical policy differences. On Wall Street today, a rough start led to a strong finish. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Today is Charles Darwin's 200th birthday. He is, of course, the English scientist who came up with the theory of evolution. Over the years, that theory has been applied to all sorts of fields beyond just science and biology. If ever there was a place that the phrase survival of the fittest applies, you'd think it'd be Wall Street. But commentator Natasha Loader says recent events show us that selection in business is far from natural.
When the economy is strong, it's easy to kid ourselves that the market is Darwinian. In other words, that the least fit companies go out of business, leaving only the strongest. But in times like these, it's much easier to see why this isn't how our world works. If nature were to run its course in markets right now, we'd see a mass extinction. But because many businesses serve vital social functions, we're not letting this happen. We need the banks to survive, so we're bailing them out. Ditto Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac or AIG. Artificial selection is what humans do. We regulate everything from how much capital banks must have to how companies treat their employees. Sure, there's some natural selection going on out there, Microsoft killed Netscape, using its power as the dominant breeder. And of course there are more companies than can survive, but the big companies with political leverage are getting the bailouts. Is this really the invisible hand at work? Markets are more like unruly gardens than the wild forest full of nature, red in tooth and claw. And we're always trimming, weeding and fertilising this garden so that it grows the way that suits us. It's just the same inside companies. What goes on is artificial, more like the domestication of cattle than anything natural. Companies decide what kind of employees they want, whether they're selecting from ruthlessness or brilliance. If you want to change a company, you buy a stud CEO, crossbreed him with all the suitable specimens on staff, and send the rest off to slaughter. It might sound brutal, but that doesn't make it Darwinian. Darwinian is having bank bosses fight to the death for their bonuses, armed only with letter openers. Listen, I'm not saying bad companies never get weeded out, just that what goes on is nothing like natural selection. Should we let more companies fail? Darwin might think so. In the long term, propping up companies has got to be bad for efficiency, but nobody's really looking at the long term right now.
Natasha Loader is the science and technology correspondent for The Economist magazine. We'd appreciate it if you'd take a minute to send us your thoughts. You can write to us at marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Mardi Gras is still almost 2 weeks away, but things are really set to get rolling in New Orleans starting tomorrow. That's when a bunch of parades and floats start winding their way through the city's neighborhoods, and that continues right on through Mardi Gras. But the good times in New Orleans don't stop when the parties end, even in the face of adversity, and there is a lot of adversity down there between the crime and the corruption. Most people just seem to be enjoying themselves. That's what Dan Baum found when he went to New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. His book, Nine Lives, looks at the people there and why, even after Katrina, so many of them wanted to go home.
Most people in New Orleans live their entire lives, before the storm, live their entire lives never seeing a face that they didn't know their whole life. It is an extremely neighborhood-based city. You spin those people out of the city for the flood and you send them off to some big soulless suburb of Houston where they don't know anybody, and it's like being spun off the face of the planet. It's anomie.
And that's exactly it, though, because doesn't that sort of belie an insecurity, right? A lack of trust of authority, of the people who've let the city become corrupt and let the education system suffer and the rise in crime and all of that.
Well, it's not that people in New Orleans like having a bad school system or that they like the crime, but it comes as part and parcel of this culture. New Orleans is the only place in the United States that I have found that is not ruled by the dollar or the clock. Down there, what's important is that right now is pleasant, and it makes life, people have time for their friends, and people have time for their families and their communities in a way that the rest of us out here in what we call the real world don't. It is a very seductive lifestyle, but it is not a place where a high premium is placed on getting stuff done.
You tell the story of this city and of the storm and of its history through the lives of nine people, one of whom is a businessman named Billy Grace. Tell us about him and what you learned about New Orleans telling his story.
Billy is something of a striver, and he pays a social price for that. And he lets it known that he's looking for business opportunities, and he does not make it into the Louisiana Club, which is one of the very exclusive lunch clubs in New Orleans, and that stings. And it's never really spoken why he doesn't make it into the Louisiana Club, but he is made to understand that perhaps he's just a little too pushy. He's a little too work-oriented. We don't need that kind of industry and energy ruffling the very still atmosphere inside the Louisiana Club.
How has that been reflected in the, 3.5 years now since Katrina hit this place? How is that affecting the rebuilding and the repopulation of the city?
You see a lot of activity individually. Neighbors helping each other rebuild their houses. It's one street in the Lower Ninth Ward where everybody is coming back. What did not happen manifestly in New Orleans after the flood was any kind of large, top-down, planned recovery. There was all this talk about making New Orleans bigger and better, and all these, you know, new urbanism and mixed-income neighborhoods. But I think people heard these plans to make the city bigger and better as a plan to make the city run by the dollar and the clock, the way the rest of the United States is. And people said, we don't want that. But to say nothing has happened in New Orleans is a lie.
Do you worry at all that maybe you've been too captivated by New Orleans to see the destruction?
I'm a partisan. I'll admit it. I love the city. People ask me, what's going to happen to New Orleans? And I say, look, you know, I think that in 10 or 15 years, New Orleans will be the disorganized, impoverished, violent, screwed up, corrupt city it was before the storm. And that's really the way they want it.
You know, your take on this city, that they're really in it for the moment, that time and money don't really mean anything. It's got a certain charm, but how's it going to play down in New Orleans if we went out and asked people what they think of this book?
I think it'll play well. New Orleans is proud of itself, and it's proud of itself for all the reasons that I love it.
Dan Baum covered Katrina and New Orleans for The New Yorker. His book about the city is called Nine Lives, Death and Life in New Orleans. Dan, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, taking the chance out of romance.
The most important thing is that the man should love my child, be well-educated and polite and not too much different in age.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials closed down less than a tenth percent today, 6,7932. The NASDAQ gained roughly 0.75%, 11 points, finished at 1541. The S&P 500 slipped nearly 0.2%, 1.5 points, ended the day at 835. Investors gobbled up restaurant stocks today as several companies released better-than-expected earnings. Buffalo Wild Wings flew up 34%. Chipotle Mexican Grill sparked up 12%. Burger King jumped 4%. Coca-Cola fizzed up 7.5% today after the company announced it's selling more products worldwide. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.7%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 1-888-VANGUARD. Want more from Marketplace's special Fallout coverage? It's all on our website. You'll find special podcasts, videos, and the Marketplace Decoder, a special guide to financial terms and products. Go to marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up tomorrow, Friday the 13th. The University of Michigan releases its preliminary February survey of consumer sentiment. Fashion Week gets underway in New York. This year, life-size Barbie outfits hit the catwalk. The doll turns 50 in March. And to benefit our feathered friends, the annual Great Backyard Bird Count begins, creating a record of where the birds are. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. Complicated as the global economy is, it's not all massive conglomerates and nameless multinationals out there. Once you strip all that away, you discover it's really about a single worker doing a job and trying to get by. Today on our series Working, we go to Vietnam. It's a popular destination for Korean men on what are known as matrimonial holidays. In just 3 days, they can choose a bride, marry her, and take her on a romantic honeymoon, all for about $10,000. Police are cracking down, though, because the women are sometimes tricked into thinking that they'll be brides, but instead they wind up in factories or are forced into prostitution. There are still some semi-legitimate marriage brokers out there who say they're just trying to help couples find that happy ending. And Kelly McEvers introduces us to one of them.
When Hung Nga first started working in the marriage business, she says it made her feel sad. She felt like Vietnamese girls were being treated like yellow potatoes, cheap and abundant and for sale year-round. These days, though, Nga says she's getting used to it.
Please line up here. You go first. Look at the camera. Answer loudly and clearly.
It's day one of a 3-day marriage package in the northern Vietnamese city of Haiphong. Nga corrals dozens of women in their late teens and 20s into a shabby hotel restaurant.
Họ tên. What's your name? What's your age?
Họ tên.
The candidates wear crisp jeans and flimsy tops that show off fancy bras. Their parents work on farms or in factories in rural villages nearby.
What's your weight and height? Did you finish high school?
At 29, Nga doesn't look much older than the girls, just more tired. Standing next to Nga is her boss, Mr. Cho, from South Korea. For years, he's been selling these marriage packages back in Korea, then escorting grooms here to Vietnam. Today, it's just one groom. He's 40 years old and a bit shy. The package has cost him thousands of dollars.
This groom is a good man. He is getting a PhD in philosophy and palm reading.
Nga learned to speak Korean after she moved to Seoul 10 years ago. Her Vietnamese husband was running an import-export business there. Nga ended up translating for Vietnamese girls who married Korean men. She returned to Vietnam 2 years ago. She met Mr. Cho on a bus when he overheard her speaking Korean. After that, Cho offered her a job with his marriage business.
This groom has a farm. His father is 87 years old. Are you willing to tend the old man and the farm?
Nga and Cho lead the groom up and down the row of girls, quizzing them to see which one will be the hardest worker and most dedicated wife. The groom narrows his choices down to three and reads their palms. Finally, he points to a soft-spoken but confident 21-year-old who works at a local supermarket. Nga leads the bride-to-be to a table set for a celebration dinner.
You're getting married tomorrow, so please call anyone from your family. Don't even think about changing your mind.
Day two is miserable with rain. The group heads out of the city to see the bride's family.
Yeah, they've got this really nice, fancy, coral-colored two-story house, lots of wood.
The house is the biggest one in the village. It belongs to the bride's aunt, whose daughter also married a South Korean man. The bride doesn't actually live here. She and her mother have a much more humble house in the countryside.
Okay, so the mom is sitting down on a mat. I think the groom is going to formally ask her permission. Nga is explaining everything.
The mother has only this daughter, so please help this bride. The father died a long time ago.
Nga says poor Vietnamese girls like this one aren't just looking for money.
They read in newspapers that Korean men are romantic and love their wives. In Vietnam, a rich and handsome man would never marry a girl like them. And these girls don't want to be with poor guys who drink too much, because those kind of men do nothing to help their wives and their children.
Nga says marrying a foreigner isn't the only way to have a better life. She herself grew up in a poor village in central Vietnam. She studied accounting at a vocational school and married a local businessman.
We're poor in Vietnam, so we have to try our best to study and work hard. Of course, I am much luckier than these girls, but that's because of my efforts and my thinking.
Nga poses the family for a quick photo. Then she whisks the group back to the hotel, where a dress, hairstylist, and photographer are waiting for the bride. The ceremony is in the same room as the bride audition was the night before. All part of the package, says Nga. Nga escorts the bride and groom up to a small stage and helps them pop a bottle of champagne. The bride's relatives stay for dinner and a round of toasts. Then they pack leftovers in styrofoam containers and leave. Outside the ceremony room, my interpreter, Thuy, tells me something weird is going on between Nga and a man who wasn't in the wedding party.
But that guy wanted to take some money or something that was making her angry.
Turns out the guy works for a madam. These are the women who recruit poor girls from the countryside and bring them to brokers like Nga and her boss, Mr. Cho. In this case, the bride's family has taken out a loan to pay about $1,200 to the madam. But the madam has sent this man to demand even more. He says he wants an envelope of money the groom gave the family as a gift.
He's waiting for her to get the envelope.
But it's not his. It's for the family.
Yeah, but she said if otherwise, he would not process the paperwork.
So he's threatening.
I think so.
The man follows the wedding party into the hotel parking garage.
Even the bride is kind of worried.
This is the shady part of the marriage business in Vietnam. What Nga does is technically legal. There are more than a dozen other businesses like hers in this province alone. What the madams do is illegal because the government says they're selling women. Nga could get in trouble for doing business with them. She says her salary makes it worth the risk. $1,000 a month from Mr. Cho, a huge amount of money in Vietnam. Nga finally sends the man away and shoos everyone up to their hotel rooms. Day 3 is the honeymoon, a boat ride on spectacular Ha Long Bay. The bride and groom photograph each other in front of the bay's eerie vertical islands. Then the group heads back to the capital, Hanoi. This is where the bride will stay while she studies Korean and waits for a visa to join her husband in Korea. Nga pays the driver and hurries home without saying goodbye. Tonight is her daughter's 8th birthday party. The next day, Nga is a housewife again. She drives her daughter to the first day of the school year. Later, in a noisy cafe, Nga says she really doesn't feel bad about this work. She says she's helping these girls, making sure they don't end up with abusive husbands or, worse, get trafficked to Korea as unpaid laborers or prostitutes. But she admits she wouldn't want her own daughter's fate to depend on a 3-day marriage package.
If she went to study in Korea and found a good man, then I would allow it. The most important thing is that the man should love my child, be well-educated and polite and not too much different in age.
Nga says she has high hopes for her daughter. An artist, a banker, a flight attendant maybe. As long as she's not just another yellow potato, she says, for sale at the market.
Kelly McEvers went to Vietnam to get that story for us. Our series, Working, is a collaboration with Homelands Productions. We've got pictures and more about Hung Nga on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, not only is it the 200th anniversary of Charles Darwin's birth, as you may have heard, Abraham Lincoln was born on this day in 1809. To mark the occasion, the U.S. Mint has redesigned the penny. There will be 4 new ones rolled out over the next year. The first one was today. The front's going to be the same. They just changed the back. Today's has a log cabin where the picture of the memorial used to be, seeing as how the 16th president was born in one. And not for nothing here, but 43% of the U.S. population says we ought to get rid of the penny once and for all. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow lost 6 points, 0.1%. The NASDAQ rose 11.75%. The S&P 500 fell 1 point. That is 0.1%. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up next time on the program, sizing up the windfall of White House fashion.
The fashion industry, like any other industry, is looking for a bit of a stimulus package, and the Obamas might just be the kind of inspiration that we are looking for.
I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.